Welcome to Garden DC, the podcast about everything gardening in the Washington, D.C. and Mid-Atlantic region. I'm your host, Kathy Gents. I'm the editor of Washington Gardener magazine, and we're aimed at gardening enthusiasts, people who grow everything from edibles to ornamentals, natives to exotics. If it grows in our area, that's what we talk about.
This episode, I'm joined by Barbara Bullock, retired curator of the Azalea Collection from the U.S. National Arboretum. How are you doing today, Barbara?
Hi, Kathy. Good afternoon. Good to talk to you.
Good talking to you, too. So how is retirement?
It's the best. It's like summer vacation for as long as the eye can see.
Wow.
And I love my garden, and I am gardening like crazy. I am still doing azaleas like crazy. So anything I can help anybody about azalea information, happy to impart.
Great. So I will talk today about azaleas, azalea tips, maybe some favorite varieties. First, let's talk about your garden. So now that you get to do it full time, are you finding that you're getting finally to plant up all those pots that have been sitting on the wayside waiting for you?
Oh, my goodness. I have not. I went to Benke's, and I went like three times and loaded my car up last spring. I bought every single thing I never ever had. Always wanted lilacs, magnolias, amelanchier, pieris, kalmia, and bald cypress, and cornice, and I mean everything. And I have been designing my garden here in my yard, my little quarter acre, and it's fabulous. I'm just like, I just put lighting in my backyard this past
Ooh,
year.
That's a nice
I hired
question.
A guy.
Yeah.
I hired a company, and I don't know if I'm allowed to say that, the name of the company.
Oh, go ahead.
Garden Appeal, Nathan Camp. He used to work with me at the Arboretum, and this is his own company. And he installed drainage, stone paths, and beautiful lighting, cut out leaves with light that come through the cutout. It's just fantastic.
Yeah, that sounds wonderful. So Garden Appeal is the name of his company.
Of his business, yes.
Of his business. Wow, fabulous. So you must have a lot of space if you can fit in things like bald cypress.
I just packed it in behind the weeping hemlock yesterday after I cut down the dawn redwood that had been growing there for 20 years and had kept dying branches everywhere. So I flattened the dawn redwood, used the edging, made it into edging, and I planted the bald cypress back there, pond cypress actually.
Wow, and it was
one of the pond cypresses I just got from the Four Seasons Garden Club plant sale that never happened. So I went there and bought their plants that, you know, because we had all these plants backed up. I went and bought two different truckloads of plants from Jim and Dan's holding area.
Nice.
For the Four Seasons Garden Club. So I planted variegated dogwoods. I'm planting Japanese maples that I grew from seedlings. And it's just fantastic. It's my garden. I've got a new fire pit area out in the middle of the backyard where I'm determined not to plant. I'm going to leave it as a place.
I love famous last gardener words. This is the area I'm not planting
in. Well, I put a real concrete, like a stone circle so that it's a fixture. I've limbed up all the trees so that the fire has plenty of circulation. I actually elevated my yellow wood so that it will grow taller, because it was starting to fountain, and it's a beautiful yellow wood, Glodastris lutea, that I grew from a little seedling that's now 40 feet tall, and it's beautiful. It's just getting ready to start to flower, but I really made it narrow so that the fire pit area would stay intact, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I've got azaleas in bloom, all kinds. I've got all sorts of favorites I can tell you about. But it's because I'm such a specialist. I know that there was favorites that I had at the beginning of March that are different in the middle and different from the end and different in May and different in April.
Oh,
so yeah. I've got lots of favorites.
Exactly. So for listeners, I'm going to rewind a little bit and say Venki, where you got all these treasures from last year.
Yeah.
Venki Nurseries was a local gardening institution.
Yeah, and I worked for them for 4 years.
Wow.
I worked for them full-time as a grower from 83 to 87, yeah.
I didn't
so
know that.
I really was family, and those people were my family, and they taught me everything. Well, they were my best education in actual practical, working and growing and horticulture
mm-hmm.
stuff. So, of course, I went there and loaded up my car before they closed after, I don't know, 50 years, 40 years?
Oh,
years,
yeah. Oh, far more than that. I think it was they were approaching their 75th, I believe.
I believe so.
Yeah. And I know so many local horticulturalists who got their start at Venki's who said, I worked part-time in high school for Mr. Venki. So it's wonderful to hear all that.
I worked for Mr. Venki, too. Mm-hmm. I got to know him. And I worked full-time for 4 straight years. So that was really wonderful. Wonderful.
Yeah, that's definitely a wonderful training ground.
Yeah.
And they were so knowledgeable and such a great staff.
And
so,
I grew crops. I grew crops under Mike Bordelon. So mm-hmm. Mike Bordelon was my boss when I was at Venki's, and he taught me about growing. That was the best.
So it was mostly vegetables that you were growing?
No, we grew everything. We grew year-round. Poinsettias mm-hmm. beginning in January. We'd have fuchsia plants and other plants for starting cuttings for the annual hanging baskets that we would have under mist. We'd start plug trays with annuals. Then we'd receive in the poinsettia cuttings mm-hmm. for the next season and the mum cuttings. And we'd raise chrysanthemums, and then if we were not busy, we'd help perennials. And mm-hmm. I worked with Eva Cassidy all those years, too. She was one of my good friends, musician extraordinaire, artist.
Such a beautiful voice. So,
and we loaded trucks, we filled pots, we shipped plants. It was a year-round, wonderful, every year-round growing. It was keeping 2-acre enclosed greenhouses plus 15 hoop houses full. And then we also had outside beds for perennials to overwinter under plastic. So I got an education on all the different ways of handling container plants, basically.
Wow. That was a wonderful education. What an experience. And listeners, if you have not heard Eva Cassidy's voice, you need to go to YouTube and just enter her name and just sit back, pull out a box of Kleenex.
Once you learn her story, you get the Kleenex, but her voice is just sublime.
Her voice is like, I would compare it to Karen Carpenter. Like, that's the type of voice and tone she has, and just really emotional, connecting voice.
Yeah, and she also was an amazing, very good artist. Painter, drawing, illustration,
mm-hmm.
hand-making things. She was just an amazing artist, too.
Such a talent. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we find that so many plant people are creative in many aspects of their lives.
Yeah.
I agree.
I have a degree in fine art, too. So there you go.
Yeah.
I got that in 81 and 91. I got horticulture. So.
And then
But
those worlds overlap a lot. You know, there's a lot of artistic touch to designing a garden.
It's so much fun. Yep. So at my home garden, I am growing all the different layers of plants from ground covers like Uvularia or Epimedium or Lily of the Valley or Mayapple or even Wildflower have ephemerals. I've got all these wonderful little ground cover areas underneath the azaleas, which I have 300 in my little quarter acre. And then I have my rhododendrons and boxwood and viburnums and magnolia, young understory trees, and then
mm-hmm.
smaller. And I've got vines. I've got Lonicera sempervirens on 2 different trees just in full bloom right now. One is growing halfway up on a big white oak I've grown since it was only 2 inches tall. White oak came from Natural Landscapes Nursery as a little 2-inch seedling, and now it has Lonicera sempervirens in full bloom, hanging all in its branches,
mm-hmm.
and it's spectacular. And that's the native little coral honeysuckle.
Yeah, that's so beautiful.
Flowers. And I have it in 2 places in my yard, and I have a white variegated Parthenocystis growing up a white pine tree that I've had in this yard for 30 20-something years. And it's, so it's a nice-sized white pine, mm-hmm. and it's going to look really neat with the white parthenocissus growing up it. So, yeah, a lot of layers and layers and layers. I've got clematis tumbling over top of rhododendron minus Louis, which is mm-hmm. a wonderful cultivar of a small-leaf rhododendron that's getting ready to come into bloom, and it's kind of spreading and sprawling. And a lot of my things I do in at this time of year is I dig out rooted layers and give them to people. Mm-hmm. I've already moved azaleas around in my yard that proved to be too big where they were growing, or others mm-hmm. too small. I've already cut back azaleas and things that flower. The best time to shape them or to remedial prune is right after they flower. So you catch them at their during their growth of flush of growth that occurs after you cut it. Mm-hmm. And I've cut back in my little yard a couple truckloads already. And
wow.
I put it all in the back corner where I have compost that just, I step on it, break it down, and just the same pallet. It's a four pallets dimension, and it's as tall as I can make it, and I just keep heaving everything I cut in this yard into it, and it just keeps taking it all. Believe me, I don't know how. I've already weeded vines. I've already weeded like 10 foot of English ivy that got into my yard, and poison ivy, and I've already weeded out oriental bittersweet in my yard, and so I'm just saying these are things that I've already done this spring.
Yeah, this
in the last few weeks.
We were talking earlier before we started recording that it's been such a great spring for gardening.
Yes.
Such a long, cool,
yes.
And enough wet and enough dry days that you can get out there.
Yeah.
And we haven't had that 95-degree day that just blew out all the bulbs.
Right.
That made the tulips open up wide and then die.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's been
almost,
I would say, English-like spring.
It's been amazing. I mean, as a retiree, I am like, I was ready for this to have my every day available to work in my own yard.
Mm-hmm.
But it's happening to the rest of the population, too.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing all my friends' gardens on Facebook posts, and I'm just loving all my friends, you know, gardening.
Mm-hmm.
It's just great.
And we were talking, you had mentioned Four Seasons Garden Club, where you had gotten some recent plant purchases, because normally Four Seasons Garden Club, which is a garden club that spans the D.C. area and meets at each other's homes, and is mainly made up of plant geeks, is what I call them. So these are people who are like hardcore plant geeks. And they have a very active discussion group. And so there's a lot of conversation going back and forth about that, you know, debating Latin names and what's the best cultivar, this and that. So if you're a diehard plant geek, you know, look up the Four Seasons Garden Club. That's the local garden club for you. Disappointing that they had potted up a lot of member plants.
Which was a big, wonderful initiative. It was a huge initiative, and everyone worked together and helped pot up all these bare roots that were ordered ahead of time, and so you have to deal with it. And we all pitched in early March, and we did it, and then suddenly the world changed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so mostly they sell at two events, which is the American Horticultural Society's Spring Garden Market in April, and then the Green Spring Garden's big spring plant sale in May. So missing both those events, obviously selling to members first, then maybe Jim and Dan, who do a lot of the plant schlepping, will probably figure out another way to get those plants out.
Well, since everything was just potted up, they
mm-hmm.
can hold on to it and grow it until next spring. And so those guys are the best, especially Jim, that he can, you know, to have overseeing that stuff. And whatever doesn't sell, they'll just keep it and raise it, keep it growing.
Mm-hmm. And I use the term the pot ghetto, because that's what my driveway is. hundreds of little plant pots of divisions and things that I'm bringing to plant swaps, or I'm going to share with garden club members. So those are always coming and going. So that's the mark of a real real diehard plant geek in my book. Is that from ghetto?
I actually have a potting table outside, and underneath it are at least, I don't know, 500 plastic pots that I've saved, so that once my perennial clumps and others get to size, I am planning to be able to pot them up and donate them to plant sales and plant exchanges, too. Yeah. So that's my future plan.
Right. So let's talk about where you just retired from, the U.S. National Arboretum, which is within the District of Columbia in Washington, D.C., and it's under the USDA, so under the Department of Agriculture.
Yep.
And you were in charge of the azalea collection, which is on a large hillside.
Best job ever.
Yep.
Best job ever.
And that was your baby. And
it was so much fun. 30 years and the same area of forest, large, 20, 30 acres, something like that. Sliding number, depending on who's counting. I took care of the road, across the road, the trees that hung over the road. I took care of above the azaleas, up above the drainage that led into the azaleas. I took care of the whole thing, and it was wonderful, complex, beautiful, just large, immense, plenty to do, and the best volunteers that came in week after week after week, year after year after year. So much we're still friends now. They're family to me now, even in retirement. And it was the best job. So beautiful.
Yeah, what an opportunity to garden in one garden and shape it for 3 decades. And it is one of the Washington rites of spring to go and see the azaleas.
I highly recommend it. There's so many varieties that you just would never have known existed. You've got to go there and see the variety. And every couple of weeks, it switches over. The palette totally changes. And so the things that were blooming 2 weeks earlier are gone, and the next 2 weeks, things come out. And it's just, I've been planting there every season the whole time.
And so it was B.Y. Morrison who founded the Arboretum, who was a huge azalea breeder.
I wouldn't call it founding, but I would say he was majorly involved with getting it publicized because he was the first director before it was open to the public. And it was actually founded by an act of Congress and Garden Club people, Garden Club of America, in fact, and all these other gardeners from the 1920s. And Morrison was hired there in 1928, and the Arboretum was founded as an act of Congress in 1928. So he was involved in the inception and the building and the designing and the overall planning and development of it, for sure, big time.
And I'm so fortunate that I just happened to buy a house in the neighborhood that he lived in.
Right. And it was so funny. Shared plants with all his neighbors, and he taught people how to grow the plants, and he was also an artist. He started the American Horticultural Society by creating a woodcut, woodblock for a cover, and just typed up and mimeographed articles, and he drew the horticultural community in the United States together and created, dues, and then supported the publication of gardening books, including the first garden book on azaleas that was published in 1958.
Wow.
And so he was behind that, and by 1958 he was at the Arboretum, and Fred Lee was writing the azalea book, and that was also the beginning of the Men's Garden Club, kind of emerged from Fred Lee and that crowd. And so gardening in our nation's capital area became a giant pastime, and this would have been in the 60s. And it correlated with us at the Arboretum and Morrison, and then John Creech, and then, Henry Skinner after Morrison, and then John Creech really built the Arboretum up. And it became this wonderful collection of all wonderful horticulturalists and famous breeders and beautiful gardens that it is today.
Wow. And I've been spending the last week or so walking around the Tacoma Park neighborhood and photographing azaleas and trying to guess was this a Glendale introduction? Is this not? And which ones might have come from his yard, and I walked by his old home, which obviously has changed owners a couple times since then, and I always wonder if the current owners know what a treasure they have. But you can see from standing out from that residence around, a couple blocks around, the sprinkling of the azaleas, that this cutting went to this person, this cutting went to this person, so it's lovely to see that at least that those are still in existence.
Well, he was a real born grower, and so he had actually so many plants at home that he actually supplied plants back to the Arboretum multiple times. And he had not only Glendales at home, he had the parents of the Glendales at his home, too. And one of the main parents of the Glendales are the Kurumi hybrids, and those are the early, early little tiny flowering, beautiful orange, I mean, not orange, coral, salmon, purple, magenta, white flowering, the earliest of the evergreen azaleas to bloom, were bred into these tall, big, tall, hardy species azaleas like the torch azalea, rhododendron camphorae, and rhododendron mucronatum, and he'd hybridized that for hardiness, so he crossed that with the Kurumis, and he brought larger flowering, larger growing plants into. And that's why the Glendales are larger flowered and hardy and tall growing. And, but there's so many species that he utilized during the 20 years of his breeding that you'll see a lot of variety. You won't just see the same typical characteristics. There's a lot of variety.
Yeah, so his main goals were obviously hardiness for our region.
Yeah,
and
extending the bloom. Extending the season.
And also extending the hardiness maybe to outside the region, so azaleas are, you know, could go up to New York State and that sort of thing.
He sent them all around, and we found that they did not do as well. I mean, the Arnold Arboretum, I think, dismantled their Glendales that they had left. But Morrison sent them to everybody around, the people he had become acquainted with through his horticultural magazine, and all around the country, and he sent them to England. And he got them established in different places. In some places, they did better than others. So I think they even had trouble with them at Longwood.
Yeah.
So they were, I mean, but then, you know, depending on certain places, it just certain ones were hardier than others. But, yes, he worked very hard and shipped them around and sent them out and gave them to people. And just it was a passion. And he did it after he retired for the rest of his life. He hybridized, but they called him backacres once he retired. And he called them backacres.
Nice. So I was going to talk about two different ways you could collect azaleas. First is what I recommend, which is the wardrobe approach of having early, mid, and late season bloomers so that you have a progression of bloom either across your yard or in discrete groups. So there's something blooming at all times. For several months, instead of what I find a lot of beginning gardeners doing is they go to a big box store on Mother's Day weekend, they pick out that azalea that's in bloom that day.
Yep, and they buy five of them.
Yep, and then add them to their yard, and then they'll always have that same couple weeks of bloom every year, but nothing before and after.
Right.
Do you have any recommendations for early, mid, and late pairings?
Well, I mean, pairing, early, mid, and late pairing. Well, I actually early was planting, was growing hardy firefly, Carminatus blendens, Ayano Kumuri, Futisa Diyama, Dayspring, which is a Glendale. What I was listing were a bunch of cultivars of Kurumis. Those are the earlies. Then now it's mid-season, and mid-season is kicking in, and I love my Midnight Flare, which is a really dark red Harris that's sprawling and spreading. I've got this beautiful later-blooming Amy, which is a Tom Dodd hybrid of gorgeous mid-season Amy. Dauntless, which is a Glendale, is now coming into bloom. And
I love that
purple.
I love that.
I've got Carafune, which is a Kurumi that's like black-red. I tend to like the dark reds because it contrasts with my green foliage. Tina's World is a Bowie Mill that has a beautiful strappy purple flower that is not like Caroma shikaboo. It's more, it has a little more magenta or fuchsia in its petals. And it's a really cool looking one. And it's spelled Tina's World, W-H-O-R-L-E-D, Tina's World. And because the petals are whorled in an interesting way. Cicadera, which is also called Indica Magnifica, is a beautiful mid-season. I have it, and it's all over Tacoma Park. It's like almost a white flower with a dark pink blotch on every single flower, and it's like these eyeballs looking at you. It's from distance because it's so pretty. But it's this Cicadera, and then I have Sandra's Green Ice, which is a double white with like a green blotch in the center, and it's a beautiful late. Mid-season white, similar to the one we call Hardy Gardenia, which is not a gardenia. That's the cultivar name that Linwood gave. And then I also have one that I collected as a mid-season, Wagner's White Spider. And it's a really cool one that I planted and grew a bunch of for the Arboretum. And then we have our late-season stuff that's going to be coming along. And a lot of those can be mixed in a little bit with satsuki and can become broad spreading, and they're very dark evergreen plants, and they root and layer and root and layer, and they are just there. A lot of that hybridization has been in the Robin Hills, so your satsuki and Robin Hills are of the late ones. And in my yard I have Midori, which is sort of a satsuki looking hot pink, and then I also have Robin Hill Gilly, which is a satsuki-looking hot, bright orange, and those are two in my front yard sprawling. And I've already had to chop them back because they'll engulf everything else in my front yard. And I chopped them back before they even came into bloom and gave them to people. Mm-hmm. And but it's worth always keeping an eye on those things, but they will do that. And so I have a lot of late-blooming things. And then I have deciduous azaleas. And I am telling you, there are so many beautiful deciduous azaleas. And right now, in the beginning of blooming and all over the place, are my rhododendron austrinum that I grew from seed. And they're everything from yellow to orange to kind of pinkish orange, deciduous. And they grow upright and, you know, lose their leaves in the winter. And they just kind of fit in between the azaleas. And they just all fit in different levels of height, and these grow tall, brilliant oranges and yellows, and they're just hanging out over my sidewalk, and my neighbors are just like, wow. To me, they contrast wonderfully with the magentas and pinks and purples. I don't mind it a bit. I think they look fantastic. And but later will be the rhododendron arborescens and prunifolium, and prunifolium will bloom red flowers all the way in July and August. Really pretty.
Yeah, well, you have added one to my must-get list, which is that Good New World you mentioned.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's really amazing. Tina apostrophe S, Tina's World. Mm-hmm. And it's a Bowie Mill hybrid. And Bowie Mill, hybridization, it's right out there in Almy is where he was doing his work. And a lot of his plants, and a lot of these plants that I've listed can be got from Mike White's nursery out in Germantown, if you are aware of that nursery.
Oh, yeah. They're a friend of Washington Gardener Magazine. We love them.
Oh. They will have all of the cultivars, or if they don't, they can come to my house and get cuttings.
And they normally have an open garden towards the end of May.
They're still trying to get people by appointment, even now. Mm-hmm. Even now in April and May. Yes, they've been posting out there that by appointment they would be happy to see you.
Great. And so I was saying that's early and late season method of choosing your azaleas and letting them in. And then you kind of touched on the color combination. So that's your other way of maybe shopping or designing your azalea selection.
Yes.
Do you want to contrast? Do you want to go with
I'm all about contrast.
Mm-hmm.
I'm all about contrast. And, I mean, I've been putting whites at the end of points of beds, and I've been having others that, like, I have rhododendron indica laciniatum that's just foliar right now, but it'll bloom in end of May. And I just contrast, and then I have a boxwood, and then I'll have a rhododendron, and then I'll have a tree, and then I'll have another lower a calmia, and then I'll have another azalea, and I'll just keep contrasting. And then I tie everything together by dividing certain kinds of perennials that stay in this one spot. So this one spot in my yard will have the same daffodil collection there, and also hostas, or this spot will have pachyra in front of the native azaleas, or native plants on the ground. And there's always going to be, I keep the same things, but I've been putting my phlox paniculata in multiple places because it blooms late, and it'll all come into bloom, and it'll kind of tie the whole garden together. Mm-hmm. And so I divide a lot of my perennials and kind of tie the whole garden together. And, yeah, and this year I've been adding tons of variegated plants.
Nice. And that always adds a little bit of light in there. Yeah.
Moonscaping, yes. Mm-hmm. And nighttime moonscaping, too.
And the white azaleas are perfect for moonscaping. They almost have that iridescent kind of glow to some of those flowers.
Yes. Yes. But, I mean, the variegated cornices and the hostas and also hydrangea and the other variegated things that I've been collecting are all summer long, and they kind of light up the landscape even in the evenings.
Lovely.
With a little tiny bit of outdoor lighting.
And that was one of the questions I was going to ask you for azalea tips is what to plant under. So you mentioned the phlox, paniculata, and the ground covers.
Actually, my phlox, the phlox stolonifera is what kind of zigzags around underneath my azaleas. But really nothing actually grows under the actual plants.
Okay.
It's a low-growing shrub, and most of the evergreen azaleas I have foliage that obscures the light from underneath them so that really very little will grow under them. So what it does is it fills in the spaces in between them. And the uvularia, I guess it's uvularia orbiculata or perfoliata. It's a cutest little Mary Bells. Mm-hmm. That is kind of creeping around all around in under my azaleas in my front yard. And in my side yard, I seem to get this cute little sedum that's just sort of spreading. And then I also have Veronica repens, which is just kind of filling in spaces. And then I have seedling columbine, and I also let them seed in their little patches. So one part of my yard only has the double columbine. One part of my yard has the little tiny flabellata nana. Columbine, and then I have the native canadensis, and then I have a blue-white columbine patch over there, and they're all separated, and they sort of fill in, and I have phlox pilosa, phlox stolonifera, I've got lily of the valley, which isn't a native, but it's fragrant, I love that, and I have mayapple growing, so I let a lot of stuff grow in between them like that.
Nice. Yeah, and do you grow a lot of bulbs, or you're mostly doing
Tons. I've got anemone blanda that fill in all along the sidewalks that have been just there for the whole 25 years I've lived here. Then I've got the little tiny crocus alpina that's seeding into the grass, and I love that.
Yeah.
Then I've got snowdrops, and I have iris, the little the early iris reticulatas, and then daffodils and tulips, and now, right now I have alliums in buds popping up here and there, and I have clematis, and I have little flowering vines all around the yard, and I have bulbs. You know, I have a lot of iris, different iris that I've gotten from people, different friends that I associate with that friend.
So we're going to talk about from the beginning. When you bring an azalea home, say it's, you know, potted in a 5-gallon pot or something, do you bare roots? What do you do to prepare your soil? Do you pre-dig the hole? What do you get when you bring that baby azalea home?
Well, a lot of times it gets relegated to the driveway garden, you know, for a year or two or three or five.
I can relate.
But then I also have to either see if it's pot-bound. And a lot of times I'll plant them as they start flowering in my yard. I'll plant them and find a spot when it comes into flower as it's flowering. And I don't pre-dig a hole. I just use my soil that I've been I don't rake the leaves off my beds. All of the leaves that fall into my yard, get thrown around into the beds between the perennials and the azaleas and the rhododendrons and everything else. If it's too many leaves, then I bag them. But most of the time, I keep everything. And so the soil has a lot of duff on it. So I just sort of mix that in. And when I pop the plant out of the pot, I break up the root ball so it's not shaped like a pot. You tease it out, like sideshow bottom. You don't have to tear the roots, and you don't have to rip them, but you want to kind of try to, and hopefully they're not, it's not too pot bound. As a grower, I've been a grower for 30 years. I never let my azaleas get pot bound. I let them develop roots so that they go all the way, you can see them all the way around in the pot, but you just touch it once with your hand, and it lets go of the soil, and it's not pot bound, and it'll go right into the soil. And when you shake it up or you tease out some of that soil, then you realize that the plant, if you were to set that teased plant on your hand, it's only really about 2 inches till the crown of the plant starts, meaning that you don't want to plant your azalea too deep. Mm-hmm. So you dig a wider hole. You don't dig a deep hole. You just need a wide hole, like about twice as wide as the pot, and you just break up the soil in the hole. Then you sort of slide it open, lower your plant in, and then pack the soil around those little root hairs, but not like a pancake and not so firmly that when it rains, the water bounces off. You want it to soak in, so you want to leave little bumps on the surface of the soil, but pack it in really well so that if you tug on that plant, it doesn't just pop out again. And always, 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 I don't care if it just rains, water it in.
do you need to water it in, Barbara?
and really, I mean, it's the best thing I do. And the soil breaks down and has good leaf litter. You add, that's organic. That's what it means. Azaleas are low feeders. They just like humus and organics or pine bark mulch or pine needles. I don't like those mulches that are dyed or, colored. Yeah. I'm not a big fan of hardwood mulch. You certainly could use it along pathways or where places you're not going to plant in right away. But I believe that multiple uses, years of hardwood mulch can change the soil to a not a good environment for azaleas. They like acid soils. So we have naturally acid soils in our oak hickory forests, pine trees. So if you have a few shade trees around, that's a good thing, and let them have that leaf litter. They will bloom in full sun. Most of the azaleas that we have are hybridized from plants that grew on the tops of mountains in full sun, but they were also at 3,000-foot elevation. We are now in D.C., and it's very hot, and we have realized that to make an azalea happy, you got to get it out of the full sun and give it some dappled light through the summer. And the one thing that I can't stress enough is no azalea is too old to give it water once a month during the summer. They will die. Even the old established plants will die. And those old branches will slowly die back if they don't get water once a month, a good soaking from June, once in June, once in July, once in August. That's all you need for those old plants. And I can't stress it enough. Water is the one thing that they miss when it's not around. Nothing else matters as much as water.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, because our typical summer will have drought, for 4 to 3 months. In July, August, early September. And then last year we had a much more serious, dire situation. So don't neglect those older plants.
And even if it rains a little bit, consider this. You're under a tree canopy. A lot of that rain might hit those trees and never even get to the ground. So, don't think that it rained enough if you get a little bit of a rain or a little bit of drizzle for a little while in the summer. It's important to take care of them, and especially when it gets up into 90 degrees or higher. It's azaleas are not from around here. Most of our garden azaleas are from high elevation plant exploration trips in far off Asia, Japan, most of them from Japan. And the native ones that we have in our country are all deciduous. And so
And understory trees. Understory
and they're
trees
most,
as well.
Most of them are understory, or they're high elevation, like rhododendron Cumberland dense is in full sun, and arborescence, I've seen it in full sun, and it just loves it up in the 3,000 or 6,000 foot elevation. Calendulaceum, rhododendron calendulaceum. But others are definitely all along understories or with edges of forests, too, overlooking stream banks. Not, they don't need to be sitting in water. I say they need water, but it means moist but well-drained, and, you know, it needs to have, water can't be sitting around where you plant an azalea. I mean, it can be, soak it when it's watered, but then it needs to drain away that day.
Exactly. Yeah, I've definitely seen some rotting out where they're sitting in, like, low elevation.
Right.
Yeah. So I was going to ask you next about pruning azaleas, because that's pretty much my number one azalea question that I get, is renewal pruning of older azaleas.
Well, like I said, I've already pruned them once this year just to get them out of the path. A big old giant, beautiful Karumi azalea, full bloom, heavy with flowers, was overhanging my sidewalk. And so once it stopped blooming, I cut that whole entire branch out from inside the plant as far as I could reach, and you know, just remove the whole branch, and then you've done two things. You're going to push growth from the crown of the plant, which is a rejuvenative method of keeping the plant rejuvenated, and that's always good. And it gets rid of that branch that was hanging over your path. And so that's one kind of pruning. Then you also have the kind of pruning that people like to have, a little shape plant. They always want to have that brown puff plant. Well, you do it. You shape your plant, you shear it immediately after it stops blooming. And that way you use really sharp hedge clippers if that's what you're into. It's not my thing, but you always want to make sure there's light all the way around. So consider if you're going to make a round ball that you're actually making like a half grapefruit shape. And say if you want it to be like a square, consider a cheese grater shape. Don't do a square, but make sure it's always, there's a little way out. Do it right after they bloom, and then you'll have flowers next spring, because it takes all, if you're catching it while it's still in its flush of growth, which it'll keep doing till the end of June. And so you want to do it as soon as after blooming. And every plant, every different cultivar has its own bloom time, so just do it right after it blooms. And I had rhododendron mucronulatum in bloom hanging over my sidewalk. Beautiful. As soon as it stopped blooming, I lopped it back. And I took out that whole branch, and it still looks natural. So I'm not of the round ball type thing. I take out the whole branch, and it'll refill in very naturalistic. So I'm of the naturalistic shape school, but I don't mind anybody who wants to shape their plants. So. But if you do shape your plants, you got to give them air circulation and space between things. Right. And that's why I do that now, too. Right after my rhododendrons are starting to bloom, and I'm finding that these azaleas have just sort of come in from both sides. Well, I just cut back some azaleas and just remove the offending branch all the way. Take it, the whole thing out. And what you have behind is now I can see the rhododendron, because all my stuff started out small, and I need to give everybody a little fighting chance to grow in my yard, because I've got more plants than a yard should have. But I'm going to make it happen.
Yeah.
I'm going to make it happen.
I'm going to say that is the case for so many of us.
But pruning,
squeeze it all in there. Yeah.
Yeah. Pruning to move things out of the way. I just have this beautiful red maple that my girlfriend gave me 10 years ago, and it was hanging and beautiful, and it was like 10 years old Japanese maple, and it has beautiful fountain shape, branching, fully leafed out, and I'm like, uh-oh, this is going to grow into the dogwood, and it's going to hang over my path. So just when no one was looking, I cut the whole branch off yesterday. 2.5 inch caliper. I just sawed it off and hit it, took it in the back and broke it down and threw it in my compost. But you know, I'm always pruning things out of the way and giving things something that's aggressive and giant, like my late blooming Robin Hill Gilly. I was cutting it back before it even came into bloom, because I've left behind still a beautiful shaped plant. And I'm always pruning and taking out things and giving space to things and directional pruning. And that means taking it back to the next axle, and the thing that you cut it down to is growing in the direction you want the plant to grow. And you always look at what your circulation is going to be, where the paths are, and you just kind of take away the offending branch. Just remove the whole thing, and you won't even miss it, I promise. You won't miss
it. And there's definitely, I would say, people who have volunteered with you over the years have learned some of that. Judgment and technique. So it's a great idea to get out there and prune with somebody who has done it before.
It's called remedial and rejuvenative, and it's so healthy for the plant to start new growth from the base. Don't remove those shoots. It's the same principle for all shrubs, lilacs, forsythia, everything. And it took some of my volunteers a few seasons to get it, the knack of the aggressive pruning for the whole picture. You're looking at what plants are really big and aggressive, what's not doing as well, but you still like them both. One is too big to transplant to move, so you just work with it, and you cut one back a little bit. You remove the entire branch that's pushing into the one. Don't just chop it back and just shear it to that new dimension. You cut, remove the entire branch. Everything is a choice with individual pruning, but I remove the whole branch, and it will never cause that trouble again. What will happen is it will keep getting taller and bigger, and then it will start to lean over the path again a year or two or three down the road, and you deal with it again. Then gardening is that's a wonderful thing about gardening. It doesn't stop.
So
forever.
Yeah, speaking of, so you're talking about when they're starting to end their bloom, most azaleas are self-shedding. So you'll all of a sudden have that carpet, like that snow of blooms underneath. I do know a few azalea growers who, especially with the white azaleas, will actually go, because sometimes the white will turn to a kind of muddy brown, and it's kind of like old tissue hanging there, pluck off those blooms as soon as they're ending. So are you on that? Where are you on that?
No, I don't do it. I don't do it at all. It doesn't take away. I have a beautiful white Yoro growing underneath Acer Grisium, and the Yoro now is just finishing, and its white flowers are turning beige, and they'll be gone in a few more days. They'll just blow away. And I don't have any petal blight here. I'm not going to treat them if that does happen, but it doesn't typically happen on the early blooming azaleas anyway. It happens more once the temperatures get above 80. Mm-hmm. And the last thing I was going to say is pruning for dead dying disease. You do that anytime.
Yep.
I wanted to make sure I do that. And I always use a little handsaw, and I remove the entire branch.
Mm-hmm. So, any time of year, whether it's blooming or not, if it's dead, diseased, or has any issues with it,
get that out right away. Than the rest of the plant, like the whole rest of the plant is dark green, and then this one branch is light green, that's a sign. That's what we call a sign. Take it out. Take it out now. Besides, it's better to get it out now, and you won't ever miss it.
Yep. So, with some of those, the only real pruning I do of my azaleas is taking cuttings for arranging indoors, and I find that they're really nice, long-lasting blooms indoors when you catch them when they first open.
Yeah.
I have, like, one sitting next to me right now that's been blooming for 2 weeks in a vase.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So
I do that, too. I have some in my yard, in my house, too, in a vase. I love it. Yeah.
So don't forget about taking cuttings that way, but then also taking cuttings for propagation. So can you walk us through some of the steps? So there's two types of propagation that I'm familiar with, which is the cuttings and then the layering.
Well, the layering is something that happens naturally when a branch is pressed against the soil and the mulch by its own growth for a number of years, and then it roots, and it starts to send up new shoots from there, and you can easily separate it from the main plant by severing it with a clipping and then just digging it out. And I share plants that way, and it happens without my doing anything to it. It doesn't happen as well with upright growing, like deciduous azaleas. They seem to, they don't lean over and touch the ground as easily. But it may happen if, but the other way that I would do azaleas is cuttings, but cuttings in a home environment is tricky. I don't personally do it. But when you do and you can, basically you want to create a terrarium environment, clean, sterile soil that's been pre-moistened and drained well so it's not just water sloshing around. And then you stick the cuttings in that, usually sand and peat about 3 to 4 inches deep, and you stick the cuttings in, say, an inch or two into that. You can use Rutone. And you would cover it with plastic or a somehow seal it, and it would water its own self.
Hmm.
And that's how people get cuttings if you don't have a greenhouse.
Well, 1 year I attended the Baltimore Flower March, which takes place in early May in downtown Baltimore, and this little girl came by my table and tent, and she had cupped with little azalea cuttings that she had propagated.
Oh!
The little styrofoam cups, and she was selling them for $1 or $2 each. And so, you know, I had to buy them. I have that plant now 10 years later, and it is at the base of my gazebo. It is blooming up a storm.
Oh, well, that works. Yes. That sounds like that would work. What you want is the right amount of moisture for the cutting to root. And if it wilts, then it won't root. And if you create, either you have a little misting house, and you have to make sure that the medium that you're rooting them into is well drains well, otherwise it can rot that new tissue. So sand and peat is often used, or perlite. And she did it in little pots individually, in like little Dixie cups. That's a really clever idea. And a lot of folks, that's how they originally started sharing plants. And we even came up, one guy, Guy Nearing, came up with the Nearing cold frame where you could overwinter them in pots without heat. And that is a structure that is situated in a yard such a way that when it's open, it shades the containers inside it. And when it's closed, it prevents the cold air from landing on them. And that way they don't heat up in the summer, in the winter sun, and they will still overwinter fine. A lot of plants will die if they're above ground in pots, if they're not protected from wind and things. So that's your key, is when you start the rooting, then you've got to overwinter them. And it's a big, long thing to get them hardened off to being outside. My driveway garden is actually on the inside of my back fence, so it's actually after the driveway ends, so it's completely protected on 3 or 4 sides from wind. I had a gardenia over winter this winter there, gardenia.
So it was a pretty mild winter. So
So
that helped too this past winter at least.
Yeah. And then the last way to grow plants, and this is how I got almost all of my deciduous azaleas, is from seed. You know, all my friends are growing all these vegetable seed. Well, it's the same way with azalea seed. You can grow them, and they're easy, and you collect them in the fall. You just want to separate the, when you get a, collect a seed from any azalea, it's in a hard capsule, and that capsule tissue, if left with the seed, will decompose and ruin your seed. It'll cause a fungus to grow, because that tissue from the shell will absorb moisture. That's why you want to clean the seed from the capsule. And you select it, and you can roll a pencil over the capsule and separate the seed from the chaff, is how they what they call it. And then you shake out the seed, which is sometimes the size of pepper grains, and you shake it over top of, say, peat moss. You don't have to cover it, but you give it a little moisture, and it'll grow just like any seed. And then that's how I got all my rhododendron ostrinums and my viscosums and my atlanticums here in my yard.
Wonderful. Now you have given me an idea for our Washington Gardener Seed Exchange. I am definitely going to collect seeds for my deciduous azaleas this fall and package them up for the seed exchange. That is
it's
a wonderful idea.
Best. And when you take the capsule off, when the capsule is first formed, it's green, and then it goes through a series of couple of cold nights where it turns to from green to brown. You want to collect them when they're brown, but before they open. And then you keep them separate and by variety. And you don't want them to be in a moist, like a plastic baggie. It's better in a brown paper bag. I'm sure that's the same with all seeds. And that's how I got a lot of my neat azaleas. But then when they germinate, they can be a range of colors. And so I was able to hand pick the ones that I got that I thought were my favorite colors. So I did do that. I
did do some selecting of your own and then breed those on and then, again, select those again. So
I'm not doing any breeding. I'm not doing any breeding. I'm just collecting. I'm a plant collector like you. I want one of everything. I've got all sorts of beautiful colors. And if something looks too similar, I'll dig it out. And I've already moved things. I had Robin Hill Nigel, which is a low sprawling azalea red that was underneath my cinca, which was covering over top of it, which was in full bloom last week. And I just dug out the Nigel and moved it already. And I transplanted a whole bunch, one that was about 5 feet tall. I basically dug it out, and it was easy to dig out. They don't have deep root systems. The plant was over 10 years old. The soil is wonderfully pliable right now. It took a week for the plant to stop wilting, even after I transplanted it. But don't soak it, and waterlog it. All you need to do is mist the foliage once a day after you watered it in and transplanted it. You just mist the foliage and just kind of keep it a little misty. But don't overwater the roots once you've watered it in once, but transplant it. And because it was so big and old and established that it took a week or two. And the first time we get into drought this coming up in June or July, I'll be watching that plant and making sure I give it some moisture on the foliage throughout the summer.
Oh, and that's excellent advice.
Good.
So I do want to ask you your opinion on reblooming azaleas, so like the Encore Azalea line.
Well, again, it's your choice, your own. What do you want your garden to look like in the fall? Those azaleas were hybridized by my friend Buddy Lee, who was noticing that they tended to always bloom in the fall. And he this guy was a trained registered nurse, but this was his wonderful hobby, and he just went crazy collecting and looking for plants that bloomed in the fall. And an azalea will set bud in the summer, and a lot of them will pop open on a nice little warm day in the fall. And he observed it. Some of them were more than others, and that's how he came up with the Encores. And so when they bloom in the fall, for me, it's usually after Thanksgiving. They don't bloom all summer. They just kind of bloom. And then when they do bloom, they don't open up every bud. The other buds that don't open that spring like normal. So they are kind of 50% in bloom for our
region.
And,
I would describe
they're very beautiful.
Sporadic. Yeah.
They're still very beautiful. And I happen to have none in my yard. Don't know why. I guess because they're patented and I wasn't allowed to propagate them. So the only ones I ever had in my possession, we planted at the Arboretum. But I do have the Camellia sesanquas that bloom in the fall in my yard, and I love those, and the pink flowers. I guess I don't really have any, but I still think it depends what your garden looks like and what room you have. And I don't have space to add. I got this big container, lots to plant still.
And I would say that, like you said, they are sporadically blooming, so you just get like a sprinkling, a little bit of a flush in spring and fall. You're never going to get a huge show that you get with the spring blooming azaleas. Correct.
And it seemed to come in. They seem to come into full bloom around the 20th of November, and then you get your first late, you know, your first winter freeze, and that's it. They're gone.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
You know, they could last longer if you don't get a hard freeze or anything, but they're beautiful. I have them planted together at the arboretum, and that's what you would do is try to have a little cluster of them. And some of them, are, I mean, they're very beautiful. So some of them would be really nice. And one of these days I'll try to see if I can get one for myself, but I just haven't.
Yeah.
I think I like, there's only a couple that I love, and I think that I love autumn amethyst. I think that's nice.
Yeah, I have autumn bride and a couple of the others, and I like them in containers mainly, like in a big container. They tend to stay on the small side, which is fine. So I was going to close this conversation out by asking you, and I know this is like asking, you know, a mom for her favorite subs, for her favorite children.
You know,
are your favorites, or which would you say this is the one that a beginner has to have?
Oh gosh, you know, I always say my favorite azalea is the one I'm looking at now, because I love them all. And I really do love the dark purples and the dark reds. So I love, you know, the Hardy Firefly, which is the Karumi red. And I love the Dauntless and Kobold of the Glendale. And I love Midnight Flare, the Harris. And I love Karafune, the Karumi. But, you know, they're all azaleas are shallow-rooted, acid-loving plants. And they like the good organic, humusy soils. And there's no one azalea that I would say would be a good beginner or first azalea to get. But I do think that the Karumi azaleas, being that they bloom first with the daffodils and the dogwoods, to me, they're my favorites. They are my absolute. The Karumis are my favorites. They grow ultimately to, I've seen them 6 feet, 7 feet tall, densely growing, full of smaller flowers, smaller leaves, but a beautiful form and a shape that they can achieve as long as they get their water requirements met once a month through the hot summer months, like 1 or 2 inches of soaking, say 1 inch every 2 weeks or a good soaking once a month throughout the drought summer. And the Karumis are the first to come out, and they're the harbingers of the beautiful spring. They're my favorite, and they're in the L colors. You know, the ones that I have are not necessarily as available in the trade, but they all are at the Arboretum, and you should take a look and get your nursery to grow them because there's so many cool ones of the Karumis.
And how about your local azalea society? Would that be another great source?
Yeah, the local Azalea Society in this area is the most active and wonderful group of people is the Northern Virginia chapter of the Azalea Society, but there is also the Potomac Valley chapter of the Rhododendron Society, which is also extremely active in our area, and pretty much almost everybody belongs to both.
I was going to say there's a lot of overlap between the two. Yeah.
Majorly overlap, and I wish they would combine. With garden clubs being what they are, this is my opinion, but you know we're kind of not as large of a group as we used to be in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And garden clubs should band together, and you know you've got a limited budget from dues and activities and plant sales, and it would be, I think, it would be really great if we could combine forces. But yes, it's a different, it's a world, both are world organizations. So,
Well, thank you so much, Barbara, for spending some of your retirement hours with us.
Oh, my pleasure, my pleasure. Gardening is in my blood. I'll be doing that forever. So.
Thank you for listening to Garden DC. You can become a listener supporter by going to anchor.fm/Kathy-Gents/support. For as little as 99 cents a month, you can become a listener supporter, and we'll give you a shout out in a future episode. Another way to support Garden DC is to go to WashingtonGardener.com and subscribe to Washington Gardener Magazine. You can find Washington Gardener online at WashingtonGardener.com, on Twitter at WDCGardener, on Instagram at WDCGardener, and on Facebook.com at Washington Gardener Magazine.